This is Wine, Women, and Revolution with your host, Heather Warburton, coming at you here on New Jersey Revolution Radio. Hi, and welcome to Wine, Women, and Revolution. I'm your host, Heather Warburton, coming at you here on New Jersey Revolution Radio. You can find us online at www.njrevolutionradio.com. Follow us on all the social medias and get us wherever you get your podcasts from. Today, I'm kind of following along with something Brian's been covering for a while. Brian and Diane have been really, you know, covering and diving into the attempted coup that the U.S. is trying to orchestrate in Venezuela. And they had some great guests. They had Kevin Zeese and Margaret Flowers on to talk about that. So today, I have a great guest and friend of the show who's going to talk about her experiences in Venezuela. You've seen her on the show, I think, probably two or three, maybe even four times now. Welcome back. Thank you so much for being here, Madeline Hoffman.
Thank you, Heather, for having me here. I always enjoy being on your show. You always do a really good job of interviewing. Thank you so much for having me again.
So if people haven't met you before, you've been a peace activist for 15, 16 years now. You've been fighting for peace when no one else really was on your side fighting behind you for peace. Mm-hmm. And so in that goal of being a peace activist, you've been taking some trips around the world the past couple of weeks, right?
Yes. And I was, let's say for the better part of two decades, I've been specifically dedicating my life to working for peace. And that's, as you mentioned, it's taken me around the world and other times. But this time, or the most recently, I've been to both Colombia and Venezuela. Within, I say, March 24th is when I went, left for Colombia, came back on the 31st or the 1st of April. And then on the 10th of April, I headed back out to South America and I went to Venezuela.
So let's start with the Colombia trip first. What sparked you to go to Colombia?
Well, I mean, in all honesty, initially, it's because I have a good friend who's from Colombia and I've known him since about the year 2000 or 2001. And I've always wanted to visit the place where he was born and raised. And then this past January, one of his friends came to the United States and she was staying in the United States for quite some time. And we just got to talking and I said, I've always wanted to go to to Colombia. And she said, okay, you can come back to Colombia with me. She was going home at the end of March. So we arranged to go together. And that trip from, oh, let's go see where, you know, my friend's family is from and all of this developed into a trip where I had 14 meetings in 8 days.
Wow.
Yes, where I talked to peace activists of all stripes, all kinds. I think from, you know, the more middle of the road peace activist to the more militant peace activist. I'll fill that in with, say, the Mennonite Church. She's a member of the Mennonite Church, and I spoke to Mennonites whose religious beliefs include conscientious objection to war. So I attended a couple of their gatherings. And then on the other end, I spoke in a meeting with other people from other peace organizations, a former member of the FARC, which was one of the guerrilla organizations that was involved in developing peace accords in Colombia, the peace accords that now basically lie in shreds on the floor. So I met with peace activists, as I said, along that whole spectrum, and then I also met with environmentalists and learned about the challenges they face throughout the country, and including for all of these activists, the fear of and the risk of being assassinated, having themselves or their families threatened by authorities. Because in the last 2 years, 454 community leaders have been assassinated probably from the government and its paramilitaries. So
being an activist in Colombia, you literally take your life in your hands. In the last 2 years, 454 activists have been killed, and many others have just disappeared. And I met with one of the women who is one of the most outspoken and visible fighting against a hydroelectric plant that is in her region of Colombia. And she had to be extremely careful about where she met me, how she met me, you know, it's because she's really concerned. And she's living in an area where about 300,000 campesinos are, those are peasants or farmers, where those 300,000 campesinos are affected. And she has to be careful all the time. And we spoke for about an hour, and there were moments when I just was so choked up, I couldn't talk to her. I couldn't respond to her because I just was overwhelmed by what she was facing. Not only, you know, is the river that everyone's lives depended on now becoming a raging river that's threatening to, it's undercutting the mountains of the region. But people are disappearing, safe havens that she and others built are being threatened, and guess who has a hand in providing some of the funding and support for this project? There's American money behind it. So it's not only American money, but there's American money behind it through the World Bank and through you know, some of the other support. So I'm sitting there and listening to these stories and thinking about what she's saying, which is not too many people are aware of it, of what's happening. And that's true. I mean, Colombia is right next to Venezuela. It's in our backyard, but we don't really hear too many stories of what activists are facing and what they're going through. So part of what my mission is on coming back is to make sure that the world knows, or my world anyway, knows what's going on and what activists are facing.
And are these activists across the board? You said this woman was protesting against a hydroelectric plant, but are there other mm-hmm. kinds of activists? It's not just one yes. type of activist. Anyone that goes against corporations, basically?
Yes, they're a target, labor leaders, and also community leaders. So we had considered that I would go to her region and see for myself, and then, you know, the decision was made that I should not go there because I would have a target on my back. But yes, labor leaders and other community leaders. Now, there's another group of activists. They're human rights activists. And part of the human rights fight that's going on now is that there are 7.5 million Colombians who have been internally displaced, mostly because of the extraction industries, you know, for minerals and other resources. People have been pushed off their land in order for these projects to be built. And they, you'll hear echoes of other things than what I'm just going to say. They were promised the right to return to their land. And
that's starting to sound very familiar.
Yeah, doesn't it? And the government hasn't upheld its promises to the people. So there are many human rights activists who take a risk every time they speak. And yet, on the 25th of April, which is coming up next week, there will be massive mobilizations in Colombia around all of these issues, on the fact that the peace accords are not being enforced by President Duque, on the fact that the new development plan, the so-called new development plan, is not guaranteeing the right to return, or is not taking action to allow people to go back to their lands, and then also on just stopping and preventing the assassination of more community labor, peace, human rights activists, because clearly, I mean, if you want to squelch the opposition, we get concerned about repression here, but we're not as, I guess in certain circles, people may be afraid for their lives, but
there's not that general fascism applied across the board here that there is.
Right.
We highly target who we fascistly attack in this country. So did you get to talk to a lot of just the general population while you were there? How are they feeling, A, about what's going on there, and B, about kind of quasi the U.S. sort of using them as a staging ground for our possible coup in Venezuela?
Yeah, I mean, those are two really good questions, and it reminds me that when I went, the other reason the other motivation for going was to find out what people thought about the threat of war against Venezuela and using Colombia as a launching pad, as you just said. But it turns out that Colombian people have more, they have a lot to worry about on their own behalf regarding U.S. military and U.S. imperialism in Colombia. There are 7 military bases in Colombia, and then there are 2 secret ones, 7 military bases that everybody knows about, and 2 that are secret. So there is concern about the military presence in Colombia itself, U.S. military presence. These are U.S. military bases in Colombia. And I hadn't really fully appreciated that this is imperialism against Venezuela, the engineered coup attempt, but there is also a strong presence of U.S. military already in Colombia. And the thing is that, and the military has been used to help suppress some of this activism. But I think, I did speak to many Colombians, or heard from many Colombians, and the idea that of U.S. intervention in Venezuela it's not a new one, or U.S. intervention in Latin America is not a new idea. And everyone they know the score. They know what the role of the U.S. is or has been in their internal affairs for many years. And as regards Venezuela, there's a strong movement of folks that are opposed to using to NATO or the U.S. using Colombia as a launch pad. And then there's also people who are concerned because this is also going to sound familiar, I think. Duque, their current president, is using the fact that Venezuelans are migrating into Colombia as a way of trying to drive a wedge, saying, well, look, see all these people coming in from Venezuela. Venezuela obviously can't handle its own affairs. And so you know, in the airports, on the city streets, there are most of the people who are either homeless or, washing windshields and all, they've come from Venezuela. And so a lot of Colombians are thinking seriously about what the solution is. No one I spoke to was in favor of U.S. military intervention, but they were all kind of, not all, there were many who were saying, well, then what do we do? How can we how can we address the issue? And that's because of the way that the migrant issue has been handled, I think.
They're playing up sort of the same things, like Trump plays up the nationalism, the fear of other.
Yes. Yes.
You know, they're using displaced people as a scapegoat for all the problems and ills of society, which are actually being created by these multinational corporations and by imperialist intervention. So it's also, it does, it seems like the same scenarios are playing out no matter where you go here. It's the same playbook they're using, basically, that imperialist fascist playbook.
Yes, and the imperialism is both military and corporate. To spend quite a bit of time in the mountains of the Andean mountains and heard a lot about how the coffee trade is being impacted and how avocados, the Haas type of avocado, farmers are starting to plant Haas avocado, which is damaging the local natural vegetation, the beautiful forests that they call neotropical forest, rainforest or neotropical forest. So it's both military and corporate. There's more repression and it's trying to divide and conquer some of the separation, like you said, the scapegoating of another group of people. I'm very impressed by the commitment of the Colombian people to trying to protect their country. And there's a man who, we went up into the mountains and what's called a Willy, which is another name for Jeep. And Willy. And we were going up and he knew the forest and the area like the back of his hand, and was describing just what the impact of, there's Roundup being used for the avocado and lots of water being used, and avocado is about 85% water. And he said, if you look at an avocado from Colombia, you're taking most of that is Colombian water, a lot of Colombian water. Yeah. So, was used in the production of it. So there are people who are just so connected to the land and the situation, and really wanting to make those peace accords, have those peace accords enforced. And so it was in that sense, I was there for 8 days and I got to do a little sightseeing as well as have all these meetings, but I've walked away with a strong connection to the activism there and want to build on that over time. And the Colombians are extremely active on a lot of, a lot of those issues that they face.
So now I'd like to transition to your Venezuela trip a little bit.
And yes, let's
kind
do
of
that.
Your experiences. I saw while you were there, you were posting about how what the media that we're consuming here in the United States is so drastically different than what you were seeing on the ground in Venezuela. So I'd like to hear a lot about what you saw versus what were being told here in this country.
All right. Well, the first thing that I saw, and it was kind of interesting because some of my associates here in the U.S. asked me, when I posted some photos, the first set of photos I posted were from the bus going from the airport to the hotel. And so in those photos, there weren't too many people that were pictured. So people said, oh, this looks nice. And someone said, but what, are the streets empty? Is anybody on the street? And yes. The streets are not empty. And yes, there are many people on the street. After being there for just a short while, you could see, people going to work and going to school and little some vegetable stands and fruit stands on the side of the road and people selling this and people selling that and traffic jams and honking of horns and everything. I mean, this picture of a humanitarian crisis that's been painted by the U.S. media, while there are problems and there are shortages, life is going on, and there's a lot of life in those streets and a lot of life in Caracas. I was only in Caracas and on the road between the airport and Caracas. So I can't vouch for any other place, but there's no humanitarian, there's no crisis such that it's shutting down, you know, commerce and business and school and life. We didn't experience the blackouts that had occurred earlier in the month. But I spoke to a woman. I had a long conversation with this woman who's has a lot of responsibility with the Electoral Council, which I can talk about later. And she said, when there was an outage, electric outage, what did they do? They went to work. They did what they had to do. And as Venezuelans, you know, committed to their country and committed to what is happening there, they intend to continue to do that. They're not going to let these obstacles get in their way. And they know, they're smart too. They're very smart. They know why the power went out. They're not blaming their president. They call it sabotage. Right. So, you know, they know that their country is under attack, economic warfare. I heard from the foreign minister, vice president of foreign affairs for Venezuela, and he gave a speech that I will never forget about, and kind of just chronicling since the 90s and the election of Hugo Chavez, you know, what the United States has done and how the United States has tried to take over Venezuela, to not allow that election to stand. And the word he used for what's happening now is asphyxiation, that the United States and its European allies are trying to just suffocate the economics of Venezuela. And it comes from shutting down banks like Citibank in Citibank, Morgan Stanley, other banks just shut down their operations. Gold taken over in the United Kingdom by the Bank of England.
So people that had their resources in those banks, those resources, mm-hmm. money just disappeared, essentially, right?
Right. And the assets in terms of like a foreign debt and what Venezuela owes out and the money that Venezuela has, there's, I think it's over $1 billion, $1.2 billion of assets are frozen in international institutions. And the international community is not putting in any fresh financing, isn't renegotiating current financing. It's just like all those, in addition to the sanctions, which have been imposed most likely illegally on Venezuela, the illegal sanctions, they're also, their assets are frozen. And so, I mean, can you imagine as a country if those assets were no longer available to you, your financial assets were no longer available to you from where the places you had counted on for years.
Yeah, and if that happened to this country, I'm sure we'd be bombing a bunch of other countries by now. But Venezuela is just still trying to continue on. They're not taking an aggressive stance. They're just trying to defend their country at this point in time and defend their quality of life and not have everything extracted from them, especially their resources.
Yeah, and it's oil and gold and other resources that are attractive. But of course, the oil is the most attractive to the West, or to the West, to the neighbors to the North.
Right.
But you know, it's interesting too. We did visit a military academy and had quite a morning there. But if you, I just was reading Jimmy Carter's statements about China and the United States, and Jimmy Carter said something I've known for a while, that the U.S. has not been at war for all but, and the number I used was 27 years of our existence. The number that Jimmy Carter used was 16, that we've not been at war for just 16 years of our wow. more than 200-year existence. And in Venezuela, military was used, 1840, Simon Bolivar, to get Venezuelan independence. And then the military was used briefly when in 2002 when the attempted coup of Hugo Chavez was underway. But they have never been at war. Venezuela has never attacked another country. No soldier has ever gone on foreign soil to fight a war. They are a peace-loving country, and in fact, when we started to listen, when we listened to this foreign minister and to others too, this is a symbol of peace. Venezuela is a symbol of peace in the region, and their goal is to resolve this peacefully. There's no, you know, they're not a warlike nation. And if you say from 1840 to 2020, no wars, none. And you compare that to the same time period in U.S. history, and you have, you know, virtually every year some kind of military activity, either at home or abroad. So, I mean, it's just...
Yeah, it's definitely an appalling contrast. And yet mm-hmm. we're going around accusing others of having all these failings in their countries while not looking at the massive war machine we've built here in this country. You know, we have a lot of work to do to live up to who we say we are.
We do. And we also, I found it interesting in talking to some Venezuelans about, okay, for example, housing. Right now, under Maduro, 2.6 million new housing units have been constructed. And he has set a goal of 3 million by the end of 2019. But there are places you can see in the mountains where people live very, very basic lives in very basic shelters. And so I was talking to a couple of people about it, and the response was, well, everybody in those mountain villages were offered an apartment, they were offered some other place to live, and they said no. Not everybody, but many said no, because in these mountain villages you have a little piece of land that you can, where you can grow vegetables, where you can have a goat or some other farm animal, and you wake up in a beautiful surrounding, you go to back, you know, in a non-urban surrounding. And so people said, no, we don't want to move. This is the life we have chosen, and we love this life. So instead of moving people out of those villages, the government was, you know, added freezers, or it helped with the plumbing, or did something to strengthen and fortify the shelter, the housing that people had. So you talk about different kind of value system. I also talked to another person who said, you know, she's been in the U.S., her brother lives here. She said, I don't get it. She said, I don't like it. I come to the U.S., my iPhone breaks, and they're trying to push the latest iPhone on me. I don't want it. I don't need it. Get away. You know, get away from me. This is perfectly fine. There's a kind of a sense here, or her sense of the U.S. was, we always have to have the latest everything. And that's capitalism, right? You know,
right. We are consumers. We consume everything like locusts, basically.
Right. And maybe you have it for 6 months and then you get a new one. And then, you know, or maybe you have it for a year and you get a new one. The mentality of people in Venezuela, at least of those I spoke to, was there's a different meaning to my life. It's not all about what the consumer goods I have or having the latest one. And I think, you know, when you look at like 2015, mentioning this because this is both what's happening to Venezuela is both a Democratic and a Republican Party endeavor here. It's not Donald Trump only. In 2015, President Obama issued an executive order saying that Venezuela was a threat to the United States and the United States can't coexist with Venezuela. A threat? A security threat? No, it's an ideological threat. It's people who want to live and who don't want to live under capitalism. And so there's an attitude of people that's different. I mean, of course, I'm not saying all people in Venezuela feel this way, but the people that we met do, and that's part of what fueled their commitment and conviction to say, oh, no. You know, Venezuela, we have our problems. Yes, of course we do. But we are going to solve them. No one from the outside, especially not the United States, is going to solve them for us.
Yeah, we really don't have a track record of solving problems most of the time.
No, no.
We're very good at creating problems.
Right, and that's if you look at the level of poverty and you look at the migrants, leaving Venezuela, and you look at the sanctions, the closure of the banks, the grabbing of the financial resources, and you look at all that, you say, it's perfectly understandable. You see why people are, you can see why people are leaving. The lifeblood is, and the change in the oil prices. The lifeblood is being sucked out of the country. The financial lifeblood is being sucked out of the country. And it's not because of socialism. It's because of the interests of outside imperialist capitalist countries and resources that they feel that they should be able to use just because they want to.
Right. That's kind of the, Western and American imperialist mentality of everything is ours to use and dispose of. And anyone who disagrees mm-hmm. with that, they're also to use and dispose of. So, this country has never... Venezuela has never attacked anybody, yet we're saying they're a threat when we are constantly attacking people. It's, the propaganda that we're being fed about what's going on is, we saw other countries putting out that sort of propaganda, we would definitely call them out on it and say, oh, look at how much they're lying to their people. But yet we are just consuming that propaganda and using it as justification to commit atrocities around the globe. And going and seeing things, on the ground in these countries, it can come back and be like, no, that's bullshit you're being told. This is what
Well, yeah, and see, what you're getting at, too, is the dehumanization of the other, of people who live in the countries that the United States is targeting. And when you go and you meet people and you talk to people and you also find out, for example, that there are 5 branches of government in Venezuela, including a general assembly and an electoral council that works at grassroots democracy. You say, wait a second. So I think we need some, We should have an electoral council here to ensure, you know, that all different kinds of constituencies are represented, and to ensure that the elections are not corrupted. We've had quite a few moments of concern about our own electoral process in the last 20 years or more. We have dehumanized, or we, not you and me, but the government, have so dehumanized people coming from other countries that, we're maybe all too eager to accept the propaganda. And really, you know what else I've been thinking about, and I haven't had a chance to write about it yet. But, you know, that this is one continent. If you go from Canada to the United States to Central America to South America, that really is one piece of land, one continent. And the Spanish-speaking population of that continent far outnumbers the English-speaking population.
Yeah.
And so it makes me, you know, it makes me scratch my head a lot to think, yet, you know, with all of that, which culture is predominant? Whose point of view stretches out and tries to not embrace, but suffocate everyone? Why isn't Spanish more of the quote-unquote universal language and not the second language? You know, it's about that, you know, working to get, maybe to build that fortress. And then you add the wall that Trump has talked about. If you add a wall, then it looks more and more like the United States is the fortress on the top of the hill, and everybody else has got to bow to the United States. And that shouldn't be. That really shouldn't be. We're all the Americas. So in Venezuela, I'm called not an American, I'm called a North American, for obvious reasons.
Right.
You know, so we kind of in the United States have adopted this feeling like, well, we're the Americans. No, we're not. And until we understand that, we're not. We're all Americans here. That's a necessary step towards resolving these problems. We're all Americans. We all have value. And just because we're not capitalists doesn't mean we're not people who are valuable, worthwhile, and deserve to live a happy life. And determine their own, how our country is going to be run. Sorry, I think I went off a little bit there.
No, I think that's a beautiful sentiment to end it on, really. I loved your words there. I thought they were great. And that's, mm-hmm. Since we're just about time, I'm going to let you end on that, because that was, I thought it was very profound what you were saying there. And I want to thank you so much for joining me here today and really letting my listeners know what your experiences were and providing that level of education that we're not getting elsewhere. And you are very appreciated for your work that you're doing.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for this chance to talk about it. I really appreciate it. And I hope that the education or the knowledge and the humanization of things will, to this point, I should also say, to this point, Venezuela has staved off the coup. Venezuela has kept it under control, and Venezuela, as far as I can see, is determined to prevail. And with the international support it has, when I was there, there were people from at least 24 different countries providing support. The international solidarity is so key to Venezuelans prevailing.
Yeah, definitely. Well, solidarity is key to all of us always prevailing. We are
correct,
society. Yeah. We need each other. Humans are social creatures. We need to work together. That's how we evolved to be what we are. You know, even though there are still some flaws in us, that, you know, we are a society and we need that solidarity and to stand up for each other as humans. And, you know, it's really, it could be a whole nother show about capitalism and the dehumanization of people. But since we've already gone for like an hour, I'm going to have to save that one for another conversation. But there's a whole nother conversation there. Thank you so much, Madeline.
Thank you, Heather.
Thank you so much for joining us again here today. We appreciate you so much. And here at New Jersey Revolution Radio, we are not providing that same propaganda machine that you're hearing elsewhere. We are an independent voice for activists, for artists, for those who step outside of the mainstream. And we are here to be a voice for you guys. We are here to elevate your voices, help amplify each other. And we need you to do that. We can't do it without you, and I hate that we have to keep asking, but since we take no corporate money here, that enables us to be your voice, but we need your support to do that. So if you can go onto our website, www.njrevolutionradio.com, and click on that donate button, you can be a $5 a month subscriber on Patreon. You can be a $10 a month subscriber on Patreon. You can do a one-time donation. Whatever it is that you're able to do, we appreciate you so much. The future is yours to create. Go out there and create it.